From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Lawyers for former President Trump get their chance today to defend him in the U.S. Senate. Trump's second impeachment trial enters its fifth day, and his lawyers do have a lot to respond to. Here's Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana last night after the prosecution rested its case.
There's a proverb, your mind is persuaded, but you should hear the other side.
So use your mind persuaded, but you need to hear the other side.
You don't make a decision as a juror until you hear both sides. Period. End of story.
NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis is following the proceedings, and she joins us now. Hi, Sue.
Hey there.
So we just heard Senator Cassidy suggest that he found the House manager's argument that Trump incited an insurrection persuasive. So what is the Trump team's strategy as it gears up to rebut those arguments?
Well, we know that they don't plan to take very long. One of his defense attorneys, David Schoen, spoke to reporters yesterday on Capitol Hill and said they could wrap the defense in as little as 3 or 4 hours. They are given 16 hours over 2 days, but they think they're going to wrap pretty quickly. You know, I think part of this is these are defense lawyers that are going in with it pretty confident of the outcome. We're pretty confident there are not the votes to convict in the Senate, so I don't think that they want to take up too much time. And if they do, you know, wrap their case relatively early, then the Senate will move on to the next step of the trial, which is when senators get to ask questions of both the impeachment managers and the defense team for up to 4 hours.
All right. Well, we did just wrap up 3 days of presentations from the impeachment managers trying to lay out their case against Trump.
Yeah.
Just briefly, what are some of the takeaways that we have seen this week so far?
Well, I think the first thing to remember is, and we're going to hear this as a core part of the defense team's argument today, is that they don't believe that the trial itself is constitutional. They're going to argue that the Senate cannot have an impeachment trial for a president that's already left office. The impeachment managers, in some ways, won that argument already. The Senate had a procedural vote at the beginning of this trial to put the question to the Senate, and the Senate agreed 56 votes to 44 that they did have the power to have this trial go on. Six Republicans joined Democrats in that, so it was a bipartisan view. You know, I also think that they tried to get in front of some of the other arguments they anticipate the defense will make today. One of those key pillars of the defense is this question over the First Amendment. Was President Trump just using his protected free speech rights when he made those comments at the January 6th rally? And that is the argument the defense will make, that, you know, political speech, even inflammatory political speech, is protected by his First Amendment rights. The impeachment managers countered that, you know, people like the president don't have the same First Amendment rights like you and I do. If they are using speech that would undermine the oath of office they take to uphold the Constitution, that in itself is an impeachable offense.
Trump advisor Jason Miller confirmed today that three Republican senators, who are also jurors, by the way, met Mike Lee of Utah, Ted Cruz of Texas, and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. They met with Trump's attorneys yesterday. What do we know about that meeting and whether people think it did cross any lines?
Well, if this was a trial in a court of law, it would absolutely cross the line, but it's not. It's a political proceeding. And so senators aren't bound by the sort of same rules that they would be otherwise. It's not that unusual. You know, in the first round of impeachment, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell famously said, I'm not an impartial juror here, and worked with the Trump defense team the first go round to sort of plan their defense. He's not doing that this time around, which is notable unto itself. The majority leader has told senators that they should vote their conscience on this. They are not whipping the vote. In other words, they're not putting this as it's sort of a test of party loyalty, saying you do what you need to do. So, you know, I think it's pretty obvious that senators like those three are never going to be votes to convict. And if anything, they've been trying to help the defense team because, quite frankly, that first day of when they first had their chance to make arguments in the constitutional question, they didn't do so great. You know, they were a bit rambling. No. They were a bit all over the place. And I think that they're trying to help them help themselves.
Yeah, both sides not impressed with the early defense.
Not at all.
There. No. So, after the defense does present its case, maybe they'll end today. We'll see. Senators are going to have a chance to ask questions, as you said. What will you be looking for in the question period?
I'm really honestly most focused on the questions from Republicans that could be potential swing votes. And we have heard from senators this morning, like Mitt Romney of Utah and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, saying they have quite a few questions for both the defense team and the House impeachment managers. So I think people are going to be listening really closely to senators like those to see if the questions will tell them any way they're going to vote. Like I said, we don't expect a conviction, but if more than one Republican senator votes to convict, it would be the most bipartisan impeachment in American history.
We will soon see. NPR's Susan Davis, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, one of former President Donald Trump's lasting legacies will be the staggering number of young conservative judges he appointed. Nearly one in four are Trump appointees, and they play an important role in our democracy. Federal judges are appointed for life, which means they will rule for generations. Well, now it's President Biden's turn, and there are a few key judicial vacancies, and he's taking swift action to fill them. Anne Marimo covers legal affairs for The Washington Post, and she joins us now via Skype to talk more about this process. Anne, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's first do a little appointment 101. The president nominates district court and court of appeals judges, and then the Senate confirms them. What vacancies can President Biden fill now, and which judges could retire and create these new vacancies?
Right. As you mentioned, Donald Trump did have record success in nominating judges at a very fast pace, working with Mitch McConnell in the Senate. But now Biden has this opportunity, especially with Democrats narrowly controlling the Senate for at least these 2 years here, to make his own mark on the judiciary. So he comes in with not that many openings. There are now seven on the circuit courts of appeals and about more than 60 on the district courts. What I wrote about are the number of judges who are eligible to take what's called senior status and step back from active service and create new openings for him. There's particularly a lot of judges on the Ninth Circuit in California who could step back, also on the Fourth Circuit in Virginia. So I'm expecting that we'll see sort of a wave of retirements in the coming weeks. In fact, there was one new one today on the really influential D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington.
And it's important to note that these judges have a lot of power politically. It's why their roles are so important, right?
Sure. Everybody thinks of the Supreme Court, and Donald Trump did get three nominees to the Supreme Court. But really, it's the circuit courts of appeals and the district court, the trial court level, that take thousands and thousands of cases and are the last stop for a lot of litigation on immigration policy, on abortion, on gun rights. The Supreme Court takes a really limited number of cases. So it's these other courts that are affecting people's lives.
Mm-hmm. The Biden administration won't be using the American Bar Association to vet nominees. This is the first time that a Democratic president is taking this action. Why is President bypassing the ABA?
Right. So traditionally, Democratic administrations have gone to the Bar Association in advance of announcing their nominations to get reviews and sort of a determination of whether or not nominees are well qualified. The Biden administration is taking a page from the Trump administration and not doing this. For one thing, it really speeds up the process if you nominate these candidates before waiting for this review from the ABA. But Biden is also looking for a more diverse pool of candidates for the bench, people who are public defenders and civil rights attorneys. And the criticism is that in the past, the ABA has really favored people with experience in lawsuits and trials, and that they may have sort of prohibited those diverse types of candidates. So they say they'll still consult with the ABA, but they're not going to go to them first or use them as sort of a gatekeeper.
Also, Republicans rely on the Federalist Society for judicial recommendations. Where do Democrats get their ideas for nominees?
Right. So Trump really did rely on a list from the Federalist Society. His first White House counsel, John McGahn, and Mitch McConnell all worked hand in hand. The Democrats have many more of these interest groups that are also putting in many lists of candidates. There's several of them. One of them is the American Constitution Society. But they have many more groups than just one, like the Federalist Society.
Mm-hmm. You know, the clock is ticking for the Biden administration. Because if Democrats lose the Senate in the midterms, that would actually make it harder, right, for them to confirm judges. What are some of the other ways that the Biden team is working to push these confirmations through now?
Right. So Biden himself was on the Senate Judiciary Committee, the top Democrat for many years. So he knows the inner workings of this process. Ron Klain was his chief counsel on the committee. So they have a lot of experience and they know that you have to move quickly and take advantage of these openings. And they saw what happened with the Obama administration. The last 2 years of the administration, they really weren't able to get any judges through. Biden's counsel, Dana Remus, has already sent a letter to senators before they even took office saying, we're going to act fast. We need your recommendations quickly within 45 days of a vacancy becoming open. So that's another way they're going to try to do this quickly.
And what about the Supreme Court? I mean, as you mentioned earlier, we all think about the Supreme Court. Trump chose three Supreme Court justices. So if there is a retirement, what kind of justice has Biden signaled he would nominate?
Yeah, so all eyes are on Justice Stephen Breyer, who's 82, as a potential vacancy for Biden. Biden has vowed to fill that with a Black woman. So I think that's what a lot of folks are looking at. And Breyer's under pressure because, as we all know, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had been under pressure and did not before her death. And that allowed Trump to fill her vacancy.
Anne Marmo covers legal affairs for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us and laying this out for us.
Thanks for your interest.
A cloud continues to hang over this summer's Olympic Games in Tokyo. Today, the president of the Tokyo Organizing Committee resigned after he made sexist comments about women. The Games are set to begin on July 23rd, a year after the pandemic first delayed them. But the coronavirus is still raging around the world, and it's unclear what will happen over the next few months. So let's talk with an athlete. 23-year-old sprinter Noah Lyles is a favorite to qualify for the Games. It would be his first Olympics, and he joins us now on a Skype line. Noah, welcome, and how do you stay prepared and motivated with so much uncertainty still swirling around the Olympic Games this summer?
Yeah, I truly believe that it just will happen. You know, they say it's going to happen, and I'm going to just keep training like it's going to happen. I can't really think about what might happen. Either way, I'm going to have to train.
Yeah, going to have to run. Now, I know you've struggled with asthma in the past. Has that been a concern of yours over the last year?
During the beginning of the pandemic, it was definitely a concern. It makes me more of a high-risk person, especially with how COVID affects the heart and affects breathing and everything like that. So it definitely makes me, you know, one, get COVID tests a lot more than other people do, and then two, really want to make me get the vaccine when it is available.
Yeah. Noah, another thing I know you have been quite open about, actually, is the difficulties that you've had in your life with mental health and your battle with depression. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I'm very vocal with my depression. I have depression and anxiety, as most people actually do. I just feel that a lot of people don't talk about it. And I feel that, you know, as somebody that people look up to, I kind of have somewhat of a job to say what's, you know, I'm struggling with, because I know that other people are dealing with depression out there. And it just got even more difficult when the Black Lives Matter moment happened. And that's when I really just said, okay, I'm already in therapy. And therapy's been going well, but now I'm getting hit really hard. I just feel that I need to go on medication. Yeah. And ever since I went on medication, I've been so much better.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that. Now, you're right. You say that a lot of people look up to you, and that's why you talk about this. I think it might be helpful for them to hear, like, how you felt. How bad was it for you?
It was pretty bad. A lot of people who've probably seen my interviews or even seen me race before know that I'm a very bubbly person. I have a lot of emotion. I'm very excitable. But during those months where, you know, I was trapped in the house and there were a lot of protests going on and we were dealing with what seemed like more killings than normal in the Black community, I was very quiet, reserved. It was hard to get any type of emotion out of me. My mom came down because she knew that I was, you know, struggling. And I just remember my mom and brother being in the car, and I was in the back, and they were talking, and they were laughing and having a good time. And literally, I could hear in my head, yeah, that was funny. And I couldn't laugh. And I was just like, yeah, something's wrong with me. Like, this isn't.
Did it make it hard to run?
I don't think it made it hard to train or to run, but around other people, I didn't feel like I could engage in conversations with my teammates. I have really good friends in my track group, you know, with my brother being there and a lot of my American training partners. We are always joking and smiling and laughing together, And I felt like I was always just looking at them having fun, and I couldn't engage in it.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I heard you also mention your art. So I want to point out that you're a musician, too. Not only are you an amazing sprinter, but you're a musician. You go by the name Nojo 18, and I want to play one of your singles, if you don't mind. It's called Pain.
Oh, yeah.
I broke a soul for a broken heart. Another mind falling into the dark. A different man standing in the rain. It don't feel the same. I try to ease the pain, but smoke a 3 a day. But I just can't seem to make it go away. And a bullet to the head might ease the pain.
Ease the pain. Ease the pain. Pain.
How's music influenced your life?
I've always been into music. My mom would blast music in the mornings all the time when I was younger, and I've always fell in love with listening to music. I feel that it definitely invokes a different attitude in how I train, how I do my art, how I act around the house. Everybody knows that I'm up because I blast music in the mornings, usually before practice, just to be in the mood. And my mom was actually shocked because she was over my house during Christmas and I was playing a lot of 80s music. And my mom was like, I didn't know you knew these songs or that you played them. And I was like,
what?
I was playing a lot of Jill Scott. I was playing a lot of Jodeci, some Janet Jackson. And she was just like, I didn't know you listened to that. I was like, well, I can't really listen to rap when I'm trying to paint. It kind of doesn't steady the hand.
So look, you're just 23 years old. You might be on the verge here of going to the Tokyo Olympics. You're a musician, an artist. Where's your road taking you? What dreams do you have for yourself?
I truthfully don't know. You know, I felt that there's a lot of pressure on people to know where they're going. And truthfully, I just do what I love. And so far, it's been working. We recently just made a foundation, the Lyles Brothers Sports Foundation, which is a nonprofit to help other kids who were like me, who probably didn't really want to do something in education, but they really loved and had a passion for track, but they didn't have the money to do it. So we usually try to help them through our foundation, and we just started that in December, actually.
Well, Noah Lyles, track star, trying to make it to his first Olympic Games this summer in Tokyo. You also have a race tomorrow at the Indoor Grand Prix meet in New York. Best of luck to you. We're going to keep an eye on you, okay?
All right. Thank you.
It's Lunar New Year, which means a nonstop celebration over several days filled with food, gift-giving, fireworks, and family. Well, for the second straight year, coronavirus restrictions have put a damper on celebrations throughout the world, including China, where hundreds of millions of people hope to make the annual journey home to reunite with their families. KQED's Chloe Veltman takes us to San Francisco, which typically hosts one of the country's oldest and largest Chinese New Year parades. And this year will be different.
When I met Donna Ng a few days before last year's Chinese New Year parade, she said nothing was going to keep her away from celebrating on the streets with her community, not even a mysterious disease. What a difference a year makes.
We obviously did not know how bad the coronavirus was.
When we caught up via video chat this week, Ng tells me she's been mostly housebound in San Francisco, taking care of her 93-year-old mother. She's seen her property management business plummet.
There's been tons of vacancies and I can't fill them. It's been hard. It's been hard.
And she says she's really going to miss the annual Chinese New Year parade. It's been cancelled this time because of the pandemic. So this year, Ng's all about keeping the traditions going at home.
Getting the fresh flowers, buying the oranges, the fresh chicken, preparing their home baos.
That's the small red paper envelopes filled with money that people give as gifts at New Year and special occasions. She also plans to tune in to the annual broadcast special.
It's time to celebrate the Year of the Ox.
We know that everyone would love to come out to watch the lion dances, the dragon dances, the dancers, hear the firecrackers and stuff like that. Unfortunately, we just felt it would be irresponsible of us to actually hold a live performance this year.
Parade organiser William G says his team decided to cancel the 2021 parade late last summer after consulting with city health officials. But he says it's still important to help the community feel connected to traditions. So for the first time, the TV special will attempt to translate elements from what would have been the live parade to the screen, like a video appearance by this year's Grand Marshal.
Bay Area native John Chu is known for directing Crazy Rich Asians.
But there are ways to experience the Year of the Ox outdoors, like visiting the 11 beautifully painted life-size ox sculptures scattered around the city. They're all different. I meet local artist Monique Zhang by her creation outside City Hall. Zhang's ox is bright yellow and orange with cute little heart-shaped flowers adorning its cheeks.
Most of people think it's a forceful beast, but actually, in nature, it's a very gentle giant.
Zhang says the ox represents hard work, patience, honesty, qualities everyone could use right now.
You know, people are so much afraid of each other now because we can't see where the virus is. But I think it's only the heart within yourself that you can generate fearlessness.
Chinese people in the Bay Area have been hit hard this past year. They've been a target of xenophobic rhetoric and attacks, including against the elderly. And things have been bad for business too. According to San Francisco's Chinatown Community Development Center, small Chinese-owned businesses usually make 30% of their annual revenue in the lead-up to the New Year celebrations, so they'll be taking a major hit this year. That's why longtime fan Donna Ng says it's especially important for people to feel a sense of community pride right now.
You still have to try to think normal, do things normally as best as you can.
Ng says she and her mom just got the COVID vaccine, so she's looking forward to checking out the ox sculptures and hoping the parade will return to San Francisco city streets next year. For Here and Now, I'm Chloe Veltzman.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Decades before the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, Marcus Garvey attracted millions of followers with a message of Black self-sufficiency and Black nationalism in Africa.
For our Black History Month special series, The Seismic Influence and Complicated Legacy of Marcus Garvey.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
A global semiconductor shortage is upending markets worldwide. You might not know it, but these small little chips are in your cell phones, video game consoles, fighter jets, and cars. GM expects to take a $2 billion hit, and it's extended a shutdown in three manufacturing plants because of the shortage. Some analysts say the auto industry could lose up to $60 billion worldwide. Patrick Moorhead is a semiconductor analyst and founder of Moore Insights and Strategy. Patrick, welcome.
Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Oh, sure. We're glad to have you. And can you explain what's going on here? Why is there a global shortage of semiconductor chips?
So first off, there is unprecedented demand for PCs and PC peripherals. That's where this all emanates, which is really all about COVID. So first off, people who had PCs wanted better PCs. And then without being able to having entertainment outside, like go to movies and things like that, we wanted more Xboxes, big screen TVs, which even put more stress on the supply chain.
Where are most of these chip makers based?
So most of the chip makers are based in Taiwan, China, and South Korea. We do have domestic production with companies like Global Foundries, Intel, and Micron, but that as a percentage has declined precipitously over multiple years. I think, you know, you can imagine the fear of a chip that might need to go into banking equipment, military equipment that is X miles away from South China.
Okay, so demand is higher than ever. It includes things like phones and PCs and video game consoles, but also this is pretty prominent and prevalent in the automotive industry, and car makers are predicting big losses this year, and they're even shutting down some production because of this shortage. What's happening? in the industries that rely on these chips.
Yeah, so it's really sad to see when these manufacturing plants are spinning down. But unfortunately, the auto industry miscalled demand. What happened was they saw COVID, they got conservative, and they pulled back their forecasts for these chips. So they made a mistake. They didn't necessarily see that people would still want to buy new cars even during the pandemic.
Wow. Well, I know you saw yesterday that industry leaders, including Intel's CEO, were asking the president to address the shortage as a part of his COVID recovery plan. And he is expected to sign an executive order in the coming weeks that will likely try to promote domestic production of these chips. So what do you think? Does the industry actually need government help?
So this has been in practice for 30 years. Chip makers have gone to governments to get some subsidies to build chip making factories in their country. It's a smart, it's more of an investment, right? This is not some giveaway here, because when you build a chip manufacturer, you bring a lot of high paying jobs, but even more importantly, you bring an entire ecosystem to your country, and it ends up being a net positive investment.
It's amazing. The chips are tiny, but they're incredibly important to so many facets of our life. Patrick Moorhead, semiconductor analyst and founder of More Insights and Strategy, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
The new film Judas and the Black Messiah is out today, and it tells the story of Fred Hampton, the chairman of the Chicago Black Panthers in the late 1960s, played by Daniel Kaluuya.
You can murder a liberator, but you can't murder liberation. You can murder a revolutionary, but you can't murder revolution. And you can murder a freedom fighter, but you can't murder freedom.
Hampton was killed in December of 1969 in a police raid orchestrated by the FBI. And this film lays out how that came to be by also telling the story of William O'Neill, a man recruited by the FBI to spy on the Panther organization. O'Neill provided the FBI with the floor plan to Hampton's apartment prior to that raid. Judas and the Black Messiah is directed by Shaka King. And joining us now is one of the stars of the film, Lakeith Stanfield, who embodies the complicated role of O'Neill for this film. Lakeith, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so Judas and the Black Messiah. Lakeith, if Fred Hampton was the Black Messiah, that makes you Judas. What was it that drew you to this role?
Yeah, that makes William O'Neill Judas. No, what drew me to the role was actually not the role itself. It was the idea that I would be playing Chairman Fred Hampton, because that's what I assumed I would be doing when I got the script. Because I was one of the first people that was approached about the film. Shaka and I knew each other, and he had told me about a film he was just writing that chronicled a story in the Black Panther Party. And I was just really excited to hear that, because I always wanted to do a movie that talked about these themes, especially the Black Panther Party, who I loved growing up, their tenacity and just courageousness in order to take on the largest, most powerful government in the world and tell them, no, what you're doing is not right. So I was really inspired. And then he told me I'd be playing William O'Neill. And I was like, womp, womp, womp. That is until I started doing a little bit of digging into O'Neill as much as I could and trying to find who he really was and what motivated him. And I realized a lot of what motivated him was, you know, just his own fear with not being able to be free, not being able to live his life, which at age 17, which is when he came in contact with the FBI, is something that's really big to your freedom.
Right. And I want to get into that freedom, because, I mean, we see all of this in the film because money is a motivator, poverty is a motivator, all of those things. There's a scene in the film with you and Jesse Plemons, who plays FBI agent Roy Mitchell, O'Neill's FBI recruiter. And Mitchell believes the Panthers are a threat. He even says they are the same as the KKK. Your character seems more concerned in this particular scene with getting paid. Let's listen.
Hey, how much money you make, man?
It's living.
So, like, say I get you, like, some good information, something nobody else know. Is there some kind of bonus or something?
Well, I'm counting on it, Bill. But to answer your question, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
This is such a powerful scene because it subtly underscores what desperation and poverty can make us do. How do you interpret O'Neill's decisions?
Particularly in that scene, I feel like O'Neill, the kind of character that we want to portray was one that was young, scrappy, that was kind of into the street kind of life, who would do things like steal cars, anything he could do for money. So he was the kind of person that really valued money and power. And so when he was faced with an FBI agent that might offer this kind of power that he always thrives to have, and money, goodness, that's freedom, isn't it? And that's what he equated those things to. And so his ambition was to have that even over, you know, over a group that he wasn't politically aligned with. Now, a lot of people like to think that people were, you know, especially Black people in the country at the time, were either Black Panther Party, rah, rah, really with it, ready to put your life on the line to see change, or that you hated Black people.
We're always talking about it in this way, this binary way. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think there's a middle spot where there were some people who weren't necessarily down with what the Black Panthers were doing, but also weren't politically, you know, apolitical. And so I think there's an interesting version of a Black person you get to see in some moments with O'Neill, where it's not that he's all the way, you know, sort of radicalized into the establishment's status quo, and he's not all the way into the rebellion either. He's like, look, I just want to make some money. But I think that decision, it caused more decisions down the line. If you watch the movie, you'll see it just gets worse and worse for him. He starts out doing things that just, you're like, wherever I'm moving, and then you find yourself in a spot where now you have to make a really tough and bad decision.
Do you see him as someone that we should sympathize with?
Yeah, you know, it's a tough thing because on one hand, you have someone that did something that was obviously very reprehensible and helped cause the death of someone that we hold in really high esteem and regard. We also have to understand that William O'Neill is not the only part of this puzzle. In fact, the U.S. government is arguably a bigger part of the puzzle. So to me, if there's a constituency that really deserves to be scrutinized in a huge way, not to say that he doesn't, because William O'Neill definitely made his own decisions. And I don't agree with a lot of the stuff that he did. And I don't think we should herald him as a hero. I think we should learn from him. But the government themselves, we have to put them up on the block of judgment, so to speak, to say, why were you guys doing this? Why did you choose the Black Panther Party to be the number one threat to America? While meanwhile, there are people that are members of the KKK still occupying slots in office. I think we have to, you know, really hold them accountable for a lot of the stuff that went on there.
Lakeith, before I let you go, I got to ask you, you're drawn to roles where characters go through transformations. In Atlanta and Sorry to Bother You and Short Term 12, how has playing Bill O'Neill changed you?
William O'Neill has presented the most challenging role I've ever had to play. I never really had played a character yet where I really had to dive deep into my own moral standing and go against that in order to find something in the character that made the character playable to me or made it make sense to me in a way. So, you know, it was a struggle being on set every day. There would be times where I questioned whether or not it was the right decision to even depict this character and how to balance that out. So it was tough, but I'm really glad I went through it. You know, I learned a lot from it.
I can imagine. And I think people are going to take away so much of what you said in watching this film. You know, I also want to ask you something else. It's about your social media persona. I follow you on Insta. I watch your Instagram lives, Lakeith. I'm always thinking, okay, who is Lakeith going to be today? Why do you do this? And how do you decide what version of yourself you're going to show us? Because I think a lot of people follow celebrities because they're thinking they're going to get a sense of the real person.
Yeah, I have an imagination and I love having fun. And I don't really take things too seriously, you know, and a lot of times my social media presence reflects that. I have fun with the thought and I just love engaging with the audience and laughing with people. And so that's a lot of what you'll see. But yeah, I love acting too. So you might see me show up as a different persona. You might see me show up as someone unrecognizable from the person that you
know. Yeah, you were the Joker like a year ago.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just have fun with it, you know, and engage with it. And, you know, so certain opportunities, it's used as something that can be a force for good as well, like my music, which is coming soon.
Yes.
which will also be featured heavily on my social media. Actually, if you want to see the realest side of me, you'll see that in my music. So thank you.
It's reflected in your music. Okay, I lied. I have one more question. You know, aside from your innate talent, one of the big appeals is that you feel like a normal guy. I mean, like the boy Lakeith I went to school with or the guy who lives across the street. I mean, do you feel like the blossoming of your career is in a way a testament to change in Hollywood?
I don't know. I don't really look to Hollywood like that. I don't got that much faith in Hollywood because to me, Hollywood's a business and it's not really a spiritual movement type thing as people try to make it to be really sometimes. I think that because of the thing that we do, which is storytell, which is on such a grand and, you know, very large scale, it seems like Hollywood is the bearer of the souls, but really the souls are the bearer of Hollywood. And the way that we live life and the things that we do and experience, Hollywood tries to reflect. So if we don't like what we're seeing in Hollywood, it's like the lives we live got to be different. The real important thing is us being able to break out from the inside out and be better versions of ourselves than we were yesterday. And then Hollywood will reflect that inevitably anyway, because they're trying to keep up.
I love it. Lakeith Stanfield, star of Judas and the Black Messiah, thank you so much for this conversation and thank you for your work.
Thank you very much.
Volunteers across the world will help scientists this weekend by simply spotting birds. The annual Great Backyard Bird Count inspires people on every continent to record tens of millions of birds into a scientific database over a four-day period. Celia Yopis-Jepson of the Kansas News Service loves birds and decided to find out what the count is all about.
There's a lot to learn just outside your window. I recently recorded this bird outside my suburban Kansas City home.
Yeah, that's a tufted titmouse.
Mark Robbins listened to my recording. He's an ornithologist at the University of Kansas Biodiversity Institute. And he says that titmouse is likely in my yard because of people.
I'm sure tufted titmouse is much more common in Kansas now than it was when Europeans arrived.
This suburb was probably once prairie full of grassland birds. Now it's lawns and scattered trees that attract titmice and house sparrows. Tracking which birds are in my neighborhood and when can help scientists studying population changes and migration. Becca Radomski-Bish works for the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. She helps lead the annual Great Backyard Bird Count. It runs this weekend through Monday.
Anywhere that birds exist, which is everywhere, we want people to tell us what they see.
North America has about 3 billion fewer birds today than in 1970. One in four birds are gone, half of grassland birds. Birds are losing their habitat to development, they're slamming into windows, and threatened by pesticides and cats. Getting people to count birds in their area not only helps scientists collect data, it also opens the public's eyes to that loss.
They start to realize, wow, like, you know, I'm not seeing as many birds. We get that all the time, you know. 50 years ago, I saw so many birds, and now I'm only seeing these species.
Cornell's massive bird database is called eBird, and it can be a bit intimidating for beginners. So this year, people can ease into it with a simple app called Merlin. It shows photos of species you might see in your area this time of year. You click on a bird to tell Cornell you saw it. But ideally, Cornell wants more detail. If you use the eBird app, you'll answer things like, how many cardinals did you see? What other birds were around at the same time? Cornell hopes newbies will start with Merlin, get hooked, and switch to eBird. People use eBird year-round. They've reported nearly 1 billion bird sightings since 2002. eBird numbers have fed into hundreds of research papers. They help scientists draw detailed migration maps species by species. I decided to try it for a few weeks, logged more than 20 species near home, then I went in search of one bird that someone reported on the app 2 days earlier. I am at the Baker Wetlands on the outskirts of Lawrence, and I'm looking at this great, fantastic grassy expanse with lots of ponds. And the one that I really want to see today is a duck called the Northern Shoveler. It's, you know, really colorful. It's bright. It's got this iridescent green and chestnut red brown on it. And this sort of like wacky oversized bill that I think would be really cool to see. Oh, there are a bunch of ducks. Hold on. Let's see if we can figure out what it is.
This is unbelievable. First birds that I'm seeing are Northern Shovelers. They just landed on the pond in front of me. Oh, they're so pretty.
This is when I ran into an expert birder, Al Schirmacher. He helped me identify and count ducks to log them in eBird.
There's, let's see, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12. There's 13 gadwall. And 4, 7, 12, 14, 18, 23, 27, 29 shovelers.
Schirmacher is a pastor from a small town an hour away who got the scoop on a kind of heron that was recently seen here.
There's been a lease bittern out here, which is a summer resident. Shouldn't be here.
So, like, someone typed it into eBird and then you got an email about it?
And I got the email about it, yes.
Schirmacher got into birds 30 years ago. He and his kids were out walking and saw goldfinches. A friend lent him binoculars.
And I got my first warbler and I was hooked. Oh, and it became something to do besides just walking.
Now, during a pandemic, it's a safe pastime. Lots of people have taken to the outdoors as a socially distant activity since the pandemic hit. And the number of people using eBird jumped nearly 40% in 2020. Mark Robbins, the University of Kansas ornithologist, says he and his birding friends see loads more hikers on the trails.
And so a lot of people are getting out that normally wouldn't have, and a natural extension of that is, you see some bird and you go, ooh, what is that?
And if you figure out the answer, scientists hope you'll tell them what you saw too. During my walk at the Baker Wetlands, I logged dozens of birds and 10 species. There were others I couldn't identify, so I'll definitely visit again. For Here and Now, I'm Celia Yopis-Jepson.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.